Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. In Purgatory Citizenship, Reentry, Race, and Abolition, published by University of California Press in 2023, Calvin John Smiley explores the lives of people who were formerly incarcerated and the many daunting challenges they face. Calvin John Smiley is an associate professor of sociology at Hunter College at the City University of New York. I'm so glad his new book has brought him to our program. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. To get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Absolutely. So again, thank you for having me on the show. And this book came about in a somewhat serendipitous way. At the time, or rather a little bit more about me, as you asked. I'm originally from New Jersey. The book takes place in New Jersey. When I was in college myself, I had gotten into more what we would call kind of left-wing or more radical politics. And when you start looking at the histories of folks from the civil rights era, the Black Power movement, other kind of liberation struggles, particularly in the United States, oftentimes people end up in one of two places, either in a grave or in a prison cell. And so I had become really interested and intrigued with the U.S. prison system, both from a kind of academic intellectual level, but that also then helped me articulate some of my own experiences with my father, who had been incarcerated when I was a kid, and kind of understand, like, okay, why did this happen? What was going on in his personal life? What led him to the decisions and actions that he made that then ended him up in prison? So there was all of those things that were happening. I then got involved with the anti-death penalty movement because I was living in Pennsylvania at the time, working both locally with certain organizations in the Lehigh Valley, and then actually becoming the statewide abolition coordinator for Amnesty International, which we were lobbying to get the death penalty abolished in the state of Pennsylvania. I had then gotten into my PhD program, and I knew going into my PhD program that I had wanted to do something around criminal justice, prisons, mass incarceration. And so that was in 2009 when I got into my PhD program. The following year, or in 2010, like I said, kind of the serendipitous moment was a couple of things happened. One, on a professional or academic level, you had Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow that was released, which became a New York Times bestseller. And as I always say, it really moved the conversations out of the ivory tower into the dinner table, where you had folks who may have never really talked about, discussed, debated American prisons, and now that became kind of a central topic in many folks' lives. And, you know, she also really articulated this idea of like mass imprisonment or mass incarceration. It was also the year that the Bureau of Justice Statistics released that 2010 was the first year since they had been collecting data that more people were released from prison than were entering prison. And this was on the heels of America reaching its zenith in 2008 and 2009 with over 2.4 million people incarcerated. So those were all things kind of happening that made me start thinking about where I would go with my research for my doctoral program. It still wasn't fully fleshed out, but I kind of knew that it was, again, going in that direction. But 2010 was also the year that my father re-entered my life after about a decade of not being in contact at all. Like I said, when I was a kid and as a early teenager, he had been incarcerated, and then we had a falling out, and then we got back in touch, or he got in touch with me. And, you know, part of our own reconciliation was kind of discussing his incarceration, his reentry, and having those conversations were really important from both a kind of, again, intellectual as well as a father-son dynamic, like, you know, what led to those things that happened in his life. And so as I write in the book, you know, after he and I had dinner one night, he had said to me, you know, I should really introduce you to a friend of mine. And, you know, this friend who I mentioned in the book as Wadi Dar was a guy who my father had grown up with in Newark, was kind of like a big brother to my father, right? And even though they were only about 11 months apart in age, you know, my father's friend had been in the streets a lot longer. So, you know, in terms of like street age, he was much older. And you know, tough and protect my father and made sure my father went to school. You know, my father had gone to college on a football scholarship. He actually finished college himself. And, you know, he attributes a lot of that to, you know, being a kid. And when he wanted to go in the streets, you know, this older brother of sorts was making sure that my father stayed in school. Mr. Daw himself had been incarcerated in his life, also struggled with substance abuse, you know, similar to my father. And so my father was like, you know, you really need to meet him. You need to talk to him. I think he can help you think about these ideas a little bit more. And so, you know, I was like, okay. And so my father gave him my phone number, and I get this phone call, and it was this very, you know, kind of raspy voice guy, you know, saying, hey, nephew, your father said we should talk. Why don't you come down to our office? And we can chat. And I was like, okay, like when? And he's like, come down tomorrow, like 10 a.m. or something like that. It was so very quick. And I remember being like, oh, okay. And I remember, like, you know, looking up the train schedule, going from where I was living in Harlem, taking NJ Transit over to Newark. Because Mr. Daw had worked at a reentry organization working in the community. And so I got there and, you know, we had this conversation, and he was like, so what do you want to know about reentry? And he started telling me all these different things that the organization does, what he does. And at some point, he was like, what do you do? And I had explained, like, I was getting my PhD, and he like cut me off. He goes, you're going to be a doctor? And I was like, yeah, you know, yes, that's the goal. And he was like, all right. And then he got me up. We took a tour of the office and everything. And then we ended up in the kind of main conference room where there was about four Black men sitting there. And he said, he looked at the group, he goes, this is my nephew. And he put his very large arm around me, and he said, this is my blood, this is my kin. I'm gonna let him lead group today. And and like I said, that's how I said in the book, that's how my entry into reentry started, was with kind of leading this group. And, you know, and so for the next 3.5 years, I had volunteered at this community-based reentry organization in downtown Newark, where I shadowed some of the staff, where I ran or facilitated, I'll say, weekly groups. I did tabling at events. I worked with some folks one-on-one in terms of like resume building or other kind of career assessment stuff. And then I ended up doing interviews and focus groups with a number of the individuals over the 3.5 years I was there. And so that really became the basis of this book, which then turned into my dissertation, which then, you know, led to more work in the field of reentry and even doing some co-writing with a very dear colleague of mine, Keisha Middlemass, at Howard University, where there were things that we were picking up on in terms of like clothing and the necessity of clothing, and particularly weather appropriate and work appropriate clothing that guys needed. And so the book for me was like the full circle, right? Everything from the start of an idea to a dissertation to articles to a book, right? And having this come out was really important. I didn't realize how important it was until I actually had it done. That, you know, for me, I think it was, you know, being able to kind of close out that site of research that I was doing. And so, like I said, my father was a native of Newark. I grew up in Jersey, a little bit south of that. And so to be able to write a book on, you know, a major U.S. city, but a major U.S. city that doesn't necessarily get the same kind of attention as like an L.A., a Chicago, a New York City. But the fact that it is New Jersey's most populous city, the fact that Newark has its own history in its own right that, you know, for many years has been seen, particularly outside of Newark, as a stain, as a kind of criminalized Black city, when Newark has so much more to offer. But I think part of what I hope I did in the book, at least in the beginning, is kind of contextualize, right? Like, how did these folks who I speak to in the book, who are from Newark or from, you know, adjoining areas, how did being from this community impact their lives that was almost exclusively outside of their own doing, right? And trying to think through kind of the structural violence and structural inequalities that lead to this idea of mass incarceration and imprisonment, and then the daunting task, as you put it so beautifully in the beginning here, that daunting task of what is reentry, especially in a system that really hasn't thought through reentry and very much has left it up to both individuals, nonprofits, and just kind of other do-gooders to try to help folks make that journey back.
Right. Well, thank you for setting the stage like that. I really appreciate that. We're going to come back to Newark, sort of the specifics about the city of Newark and how it impacts your research and the lives of the people you look at. But I wanted to also just lay down a couple of more little pieces before we get to that. You write that, quote, reentry is an extension, not a termination of the carceral continuum. What do you mean by that?
So often I think that when we watch films and movies or think about someone getting out of prison, we often paint this picture that you do the crime, you do the time, right? That's kind of a colloquial phrase that we hear. And in fact, if that colloquial phrase was true, then the book that I wrote wouldn't need to exist, right? Because what essentially happens is you so-called do the crime, you do the time, and then you continue to have perpetual punishments that succeed that time that you did. And so reentry is not simply ending one's criminal justice involvement, but just a new iteration of it. And we see that new iteration shows up in a variety of ways. It shows up in post-incarceration traumas, right? As we know, being in prison, being locked up, confined in these ways can have both emotional, psychological, and physical tolls on a person. It shows up in the ways in how people are both legally locked out of certain aspects of life in which others might not, or which others might take for granted. So where you can live, what types of jobs you can have, engaging in the political process. Do you have parental rights? Are all things that can be legal obstacles in this kind of you're done with prison, quote unquote. And then there's the kind of social aspects and social barriers that people might experience. And that can do with anything from rekindling relationships with former partners, with your children, with your community in general, creating new partnerships with potentially new romantic engagements, the kind of ever-present stigma that is associated with the idea that you've been incarcerated. And so all of those are what I am arguing, that reentry is certainly not the termination, but rather the continuation. And the term carceral continuum is not a term I created. There's others who have written and talked about it. You know, the first person who always comes to mind when I think about it is Carla Shedd at Georgetown, writes a lot about the carceral continuum. And the carceral continuum is, if we think about time, right, we often think of time as kind of this linear, you know, from point A to point B. But what exactly happens in the carceral continuum, especially for folks who are born into low-income neighborhoods in urban areas with all of the other kind of structural violence of over-police presence, et cetera, is that this carceral continuum doesn't go on a linear pattern, but has a like a cyclical nature, right? So you go from A and then loop right back to A. So we see that from early ages, the ways in which schools in certain neighborhoods have a much more disciplinary and reactionary policing method, where there might be metal detectors or police dogs or, you know, violation of a student's kind of autonomy of going through their bags, etc., to the recreation that's even in these communities. So going back to Carla Shedd's work, she writes in her book about in the park, in the local park's recreation playground, jungle gym area, there is something that's labeled jail, right? On the literal like contraptions that children can play with. So, you know, you can be locked up in jail in the park. Then there's the kind of inadequacies of housing. And especially if you live in public housing, where police, particularly here in New York City, can do vertical sweeps, right? The police can kind of enter these buildings because they're, you know, they're state owned, they're public housing. You have inadequate healthcare and less options in terms of access to food and access to leisure. And all of this creates this cycle where, you know, we see people ending up in the prison and then they get out. They have less access and resources, and then they end up back in, and there again becomes this kind of perpetual cycle.
Right. And speaking of this cycle, if we could just put maybe a sense in terms of the numbers, you touched on this before, but just to highlight this for a moment, approximately how many Americans are currently incarcerated and how many leave prison each year?
Right. So the newest numbers that I've seen now is that it's right under 2 million people. At the time when I was writing this book, it was about 2.3 million. And at that time, the Pew Research Center had said that was roughly 1 in 31 American residents was under some form of criminal justice supervision, which meant, you know, incarcerated, on parole, on probation. And statistically, on average in the United States, the most recent data that's come about what we call recidivism, the idea of being rearrested or reincarcerated, says that people who've been system impacted, meaning that they've been incarcerated, have about a 67% chance of being rearrested or reincarcerated within the first 3 years. And so we do a really dismal job at preventing people from going back to jail. We do a really amazing job, and I mean that very facetiously, but we do an amazing job at putting people in prison. When it comes to individual states, each state has its own kind of numbers. In more recent years, New Jersey is actually cut their recidivism rates down to about 30%. And that's a nod to a lot of the things that have happened. But where I would critique that is that even though the numbers have shrunk, the populations that are still most affected by incarceration in New Jersey specifically still tend to be low-income urban people of color, namely Black and Hispanic residents.
Right. And just to, again, step back a bit, your study focuses on a reentry center in New Jersey, and you already mentioned that a little bit about your father's history and how your father connected you to his close friend who's running this center. And I'm just curious, you spoke in your book a bit about this, and I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about what scholars sometimes refer to as a researcher's positionality, their relationship to their study. And in particular, I'm curious how the people that you encountered in the reentry center in Newark, how did they respond to your presence? What did they think of you? Did they see you as connected to this story? Did they see you as an outsider kind of peering in? How did that work out?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can talk about it for a long time. I think that initial introduction that my father's friend gave to me set the precedent, right? You know, this was a man who I'd met literally 2 hours prior and had only known for about 24 hours prior. But the fact of the matter is that when he introduced me to these men, he put his arm around me. So there was a sense of physical touch. So there was a level of intimacy. And he made the statement that this is my nephew, this is my blood, this is my kin. And so in the world of the streets that holds a lot of weight. Here is a man who is very well respected, both in the work that he does in the community as someone who is working in reentry. He's also a man who, you know, from a very early age, ran his own crew, had gone to prison, was an OG, as we call them. And so, you know, Mr. Dawe had a lot of weight. He had a lot of pull. And so I think the way in which he just introduced me set the tone that folks were going to respect me, right? Because I could imagine if it went the other way, say, hey, this is just some guy I met. Why don't you listen up? It might have been a whole different experience. But to that end, right, there was always this interesting dynamic of the work I did, because there was this kind of duality in some ways. I've now worked with both adults and youth, but for this project, it was all adults. And one thing that adults do, at least the adults that I worked with, and especially the adult Black men, was that there is this moment when you first meet them where they say, you will get my undivided attention for 5 minutes. And I want to hear what you're about. I will listen. I will pay attention. And I have found that folks who've been incarcerated are sometimes some of the best ethnographers, right? They can cut through the BS. They know if you're for real, if you're genuine, if you are scared, if you are just feeding them a line. And so there was always this interesting kind of challenge to me of like, okay, you're here to run this group. What do you got for me? And it was my 5 minutes to pitch them and be like, can I capture this audience? But at the same time, there was this protecting of me, because there was a lot of these guys who had done significant amount of time, 10 plus years. In some cases, I had a couple individuals who had done 25 plus years, and I think one individual who had done like 35 years. I mean, you know, significant amount of time in prison. And for many of them, they spoke openly about how proud they were of me being a Black man, doing my PhD, saying, you know, I could do whatever I want, right? And I chose to focus my energy on being a voice and an advocate for folks who oftentimes don't have a voice. So, you know, I think for a lot of the men who I spoke to, you know, especially as I got to know them over time, because that was the other thing, right? It wasn't like I was meeting folks for like a one-off. You know, for some of these guys, you know, it was months or years, quite frankly, and that I had been in touch with them on a very regular basis. So we got to know each other, you know, and over time, you know, even my own personal life happenings, you know, we're not 1,000% removed from, you know, if I was having a bad day or having a stressful week, you know, I had come out, you know, in some ways. And, you know, I remember talking to some of the older men and in some cases, even looking to some of the older men as in kind of like a fatherhood role or just an offering from an elder, right? And so there was a really nice synergy that I found there. I mean, obviously there was that incubation time where folks had to be like, okay, is this guy for real? But you know, over time, you know, I became a part of that community, still as an outsider, right? But an outsider that was allowed a certain level of entree in. And then there was even, and I don't want to like skip ahead here if there's a question, but like there were still things that I was like kind of kept to the outside. But then if I had kind of found out about it, you know, it was like a peeling of the onion, right? And so I was able to kind of, and that only happened because I was there so often, right? So there were things that guys weren't telling me, but then I would see it. So for instance, like, you know, I have a chapter about health. We never, at least I didn't go into the book or go into the project like having this to be a project about reentry and health, but, you know, you're hearing side conversations, the weather, and, you know, if it's so cold, you know, then you start picking up on that. Or, you know, guys having, you know, cell phones and hiding them in the building. So all of those things were things that kind of came out. And, you know, just to that point of the cell phone, I remember when I saw the guy go get his cell phone, and, you know, his first comment or his first statement to me was like, "Now you're not going to tell anybody, right?" That was his, you know, my response was no, right? And, you know, and it had to be no. It had to be emphatically no. If I was like, "Oh, well," or if I questioned it, you know, that could have been a whole different, you know, been like, "Oh, okay, Smiley's a snitch." You know what I mean? I had to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you just clarify about the cell phones? What was the rule related to the cell phones in the center? Just
so most of the folks who I spoke to were living in halfway houses. And at the time, and I don't know what the rules are now, but I assume that they're fairly the same, is that if you're living in a halfway house, you're not allowed to have a cell phone. So these cell phones would be contraband if they tried to bring them into the halfway house where they were living. So some of the folks would leave their cell phones and other properties or things that they wanted in what they would call a safe place or a safe space within the reentry center. So this one gentleman, you know, was, I think he hid his cell phone in like the back of a filing cabinet, right? And he came in after group. I guess he had assumed everyone had left that room, but I was still sitting there and doing my notes or just taking notes. And he kind of came in and kind of saw me abruptly. And I guess he was like, "Well, I'm going for it." And so he went and dug in there, got it, made his phone calls, put it back, and, you know, and it was fine. But then there were other folks who had cell phones who were kept in desk drawers, right? They were very, you know, the people who ran the agency knew that folks had cell phones because, again, we were also living in the 21st century where pay phones and, you know, other forms of communication or older forms of communication, you know, were just not accessible as they once were. And so, you know, how do you live in the modern world without modern devices? And so, a lot of folks had cell phones, had clothing. For some of the women, they had makeup, a toiletry bag there. That they didn't feel comfortable, like either in the halfway house or for some folks living in a shelter, right? You know, one guy who in the book, Jerry, he had a cell phone. His daughter had given him an Apple phone, you know, an iPhone, and it was stolen out of the shelter. And so, you know, keeping things at the center became a way to, again, navigate and negotiate one's reentry.
All right.
So, yeah.
And of course, people, as you know, I taught in prison for several years and before, you know, teaching on the outside, and people who are incarcerated are famously creative with finding places to hide things, because there's a lot of, you know, rules and regulations about what kinds of things people who are incarcerated are allowed to have. And so, you know, people who are in prison have found various kind of workarounds to manage life on the inside, you know, and dealing with all of these rules and regulations.
Absolutely. And, you know, and now as we move into the second decade of the 21st century, we're seeing even more and more of that ingenuity with the proliferation of smartphone devices and other kind of phones and things that are either smuggled into the facilities or in some instances, you know, things that are allowed being kind of doctored so the guys can get internet. And again, not simply for nefarious reasons, but for, in some instances, to communicate with family or guys who are taking online college courses off their smart device or trading in Bitcoin and all of these other kind of really fascinating and, you know, things that I think you and I, especially as academics, would be intrigued about that we know isn't, you know, some evil doing, but, you know, understanding how people sustain reality of their life, right? And trying to make sense of really horrible circumstances and conditions.
Exactly. And so your book is a contribution to critical reentry studies. Could you say a little bit about what are the basic perspectives of this approach?
Yes. So critical reentry studies is this idea that we have to look at reentry from, as you guess it, a critical lens, right? We cannot just simply say that, again, people are going to move from point A to point B without taking into the context of both history, policy, and other social constructions in which put people in these positions that they even have to reenter to begin with. And so some of those ideas is to kind of look at the idea of reentry as part of the overall issue of mass incarceration, of what some might refer to as the prison industrial complex, or as others like Doug Tompkins refers to as a prisoner reentry industry, is that there is a kind of building out of a culture of retribution that continues to keep people in these cycles of both incarceration and reentry. So critical reentry studies is really trying to understand that. And then lastly, often, and we're seeing a growing number of this, whether people talk about it as critical reentry or not, is that centering the voices of those who've been system impacted, right? I think a lot of the early reentry work, especially in the early 2000s, while really important to kind of set a foundation in terms of the statistics, the numbers, the what is happening, you didn't necessarily have the voices of the people who are experiencing this, right? So, you know, even the kind of data that I posed, right? You know, the fact that the Bureau of Justice Statistics, you know, produced data that said, you know, more people were exiting prison than entering prison in 2010. That's a great number to kind of set as a stage of a platform, but that doesn't really give us the kind of more textured lived experiences of what that means for a whole slew of people in the United States. If we think about it, there's roughly 600 to 700 people who are coming out of state and federal prison facilities annually. There is millions of people who are cycling in and out of jail facilities throughout the country. And all of them are having different reentry experiences. For some, it might be a night in the drunk tank, right? You know, you get drunk at boozy brunch and you do something stupid and you spend the night there. There are other people who are doing quite literally decades, right? So for instance, Sundiata Kolai, who was part of the Black Liberation Army and Black Panthers, you know, he was incarcerated in the state of New Jersey for 48 years. I mean, you know, almost a half a century. And what does that look like? What does reentry look like for, you know, a white collar 20-something year old who does a night in the drunk tank versus a now 85-year-old black man who spent, you know, quite literally half a century in prison. And so I think critical reentry studies is about finding that nuance and telling those stories. And I think they're all deserving of being told. But I'll stop there.
Right. Sure, sure. And speaking of nuance, what was Walter Rodney and Manning Marble's concept of underdevelopment, and how does it relate to the feelings on the part of the people you studied in Newark that the government there failed their community?
Yeah. So I think Walter Rodney, amazing theorist, you know, really thinking through, you know, race and colonialism and imperialism. And in his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, he talks about this concept of underdevelopment, not being that no development happens, but that it becomes subpar and it does not stay on pace. And for him, he's talking about the kind of extractions that Europe in, you know, the United States had done to Africa, particularly during the transatlantic slave trade. Manning Marable builds upon that theoretical framework in his book of How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America by, again, extending that same theory to ideas around capitalism and the exploitation of Black folks here in the United States, you know, through systems of slavery, through systems of convict leasing, through systems of Jim Crow segregation, to de facto systems of redlining and gerrymandering that have systematically continued to exploit the Black community while gouging them of their, you know, money, their politics, their social parity within the state. And so I wanted to build off of their legacy by also using that theoretical framework to think through reentry. Because again, people do come out, right? Most people who have been incarcerated, somewhere upwards between 90 to 95% of all people who are incarcerated in the United States come out of prison or come out of jail. And so one of the things that I was thinking through was, well, what does that experience look like in how folks do reentry? And I'll talk a little bit more about what I argue is like doing reentry. But I was thinking through the underdevelopment of these communities, particularly places like Newark and other cities that have been disadvantaged through over police presence, intensified surveillance, under-resourced institutions such as hospitals, education, healthcare, et cetera. And so I come to this idea of underdevelopment in the ways in which the gentlemen and women who I speak to in the book, and a lot of them, they position it in a couple of different ways. And they think about it as both the community leaders that have been taken from Black communities. And, you know, a lot of the older gentlemen talk about, you know, when you look at Black leaders, particularly of the mid-20th and late 20th century, how many of them were either assassinated or incarcerated, and how that stops growth in this community. They talk about the idea of over-surveillance and how that kind of stunts people. And, you know, particularly some of the younger men who I've spoken to, oftentimes their first police encounters had to do with surveillance technology, right? So police arresting them off of the statement of, well, you were seen on camera, or the camera caught you doing this. And so their first interaction with law enforcement wasn't even really with a human being, but with you know, some kind of technological advancements, as well as, you know, how we think about urban renewal and gentrification. And so, you know, a lot of the guys who I'd spoken to, right, probably wouldn't consider themselves theorists, but they were articulating certain ideas. And one gentleman who I believe his name in the book, I sometimes get confused myself, I think I called him Elijah, you know, we were walking down the street, and he talks about how there was a it was called Brick City Coffee Company, and it really took him aback, because, you know, when he was growing up in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, Newark's nickname was Brick City, and that was never seen as this kind of ideal positive thing, but this idea of Brick City being the kind of hardened concrete jungle that creates hardened people. And so for him to see now this kind of coffee barista place with a demographic that catered to mostly commuter white business class folks as a kind of whitewashing, or kind of repurposing or reappropriating a term but keeping this idea of an edginess to it, right? I mean, he was speaking about urban renewal and gentrification and how, you know, the things that are happening in the city, the great things that are happening in the city, are not necessarily being done with Newark natives in mind, right? So there's been a lot of redevelopment of the downtown Newark with the Prudential Center and JPAC. Marriott has a hotel down there. There's all, you know, eateries and things like that. But yet, if you go to certain parts of South Ward, Central Ward, West Ward, you know, those places are still very much underdeveloped. There's still dilapidated housing. There's still empty lots with overgrown vegetation, garbage, you know, and Elijah was not really speaking facetiously, but here's a man who did, you know, I think 20 or 22 years straight and said, you know, the same abandoned buildings when I went to prison are still abandoned to this day. So where is that development, right? What's happening? So, you know, boarding up buildings is a form of development, right? But what we could say is it's an underdevelopment. It's not a true investment in community.
Right, right. That's very, very, very true. You developed the concept of purgatory citizenship, which is where the title of your book comes from. What do you intend to capture with this concept?
So I came to the idea of purgatory citizenship because the kind of initial impetus to the work even of itself when I started working at the Reentry Center was I was really interested in that kind of idea of voter disenfranchisement. So I've been thinking about, well, what does it mean to lose your right to vote? Was it something that you had exercised before? Was it something you had thought about? But as I was, you know, developing relationships with these guys, and these folks, I'll say, it became very clear that it was more than just voting. For some, voting was a clear indication of something that they had lost or something they had never been able to exercise. But for others, it was how they articulated just their life in general. And there was, I believe the gentleman who's in the book called Sharif, and he talks about this idea that once you've been in prison, there's always this kind of limbo feeling where you're one foot in, one foot out. You always have to be kind of perfect because if you're not perfect, right, the margin of error, the rope that which you have to mess up is so much shorter. And that really in an instance, you can be sent back to prison. Your freedoms can be taken away. And so there's this constant idea that you have to do reentry. You have to, you know, reentry is not simply a noun, but it's a verb, right? It's this term that has actionable consequences, positive or negative, whether you engage or not engage. And so this idea of purgatory came to me as a, you know, I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic school, K through 12th grade. So the kind of religious idea of purgatory had always kind of been in my mind about, you know, you have to atone for a certain amount of sins before you're let into heaven. And so I was seeing that same kind of model happen in reentry, that a lot of these guys had to atone or engage in a particular way that highlighted that they were doing reentry. So, you know, I had folks who told me, you know, I'm all grouped out, meaning that, you know, they had been in different types of groups in prison, in the halfway house, now the community-based reentry center, but they were like, and it's not that they didn't want to do, but they're like, you know, how many times am I going to hear that I was a bad person and that I just need to do better, right? Or, you know, how many times am I going to have to sit through this kind of program? Or what programs actually are valued, right? What programs actually have tangible substance behind them versus simply a certificate? And, you know, I think you see that. And again, this wasn't people who were ungrateful, but they at some level were seeing the forest for the trees, that, you know, having a certificate that they engaged in a discussion group, right, doesn't really have a lot of juice for them, maybe personally, but it has a lot of juice in the eyes of a judge. And so, yeah, that's how I kind of came to the term purgatory citizen, was kind of how these folks were really kind of seeing the way that they navigated and negotiated their lives kind of between two worlds. One that was, you know, not totally an out group, right? Because, you know, if these folks who I were talking to were, you know, non-U.S. citizens, they could be deported. Well, they can't be deported. They were born here. They're naturalized citizens here. And they're not a total in-group, right? They still have this kind of ever-present, you know, hidden hand that could come down and snatch their freedom. They're living in this kind of limbo status. And for some, you know, they were very honest. They didn't know when that would end.
And that it's possible, potentially anyway, that this limbo status may be, you know, their fate for their entire life. Until they die, they'll always be in this state of limbo, not quite in prison, but also not quite, you know, 100% free on the outside either.
Absolutely. And, you know, for some of the men in particular who I spoke to, some of them had life with parole, right? Meaning that even when they were let out, part of their being released stipulation was that they had parole for the remainder of their life. You know, and I think it was Melvin at the beginning of the book, you know, his parole ends, you know, according to New Jersey Department of Corrections website, like December 31st, 2999, right? You know, almost a millennium away. And it's just, you know, and it's mind-boggling. It's also kind of ridiculous to see, right? But it's so much part of the larger kind of retributive and punishment system that we have, that we all know that this man is nobody. Anyone listening to this podcast, there's no one on this podcast who's going to be alive in 2999, right? If you're alive today listening to this, you're not going to be. So to even have that it's kind of like this further punishment to like really make sure that this person knows that you will never be outside of the grips of the criminal legal supervision.
Yeah, and it's interesting, just to riff for a second, you mentioned about your Catholic background and the religious imagery, you know, and how you came to this term, purgatory citizenship. And it's interesting because in a way, when you were describing about Melvin and his millennium-long, you know, sentence or, you know, whatever, stipulation for his probation, you know, it almost sounds like a religious dictate. Because, again, if you think of a, you know, sociologist, we think about the, you know, the bureaucratic state as, you know, in the modern government, we think of a secular institution that works according to kind of a secular logic. You know, from that perspective, it makes no sense to give someone, or to even write down, that someone has a millennium long
parole.
Like, it's an absurdity. Like, it just doesn't make sense. But if you think about it from a sort of religious perspective, it's like saying you're going to hell. Like, you will be in this, you know, for 1,000 years. It really does, it seems to me, make a lot more sense from a kind of religious from a religious lens or in a religious valence, rather than in a secular democracy.
Yeah. And, you know, and this book is not, you know, and I'm not like a religious studies scholar, but there's certainly overlay here that we can see, and even how folks even think about their time, because, you know, that was also part of the doing reentry was, you know, kind of asking folks, like, do you think that, you know, say someone lives to be 90 plus years old, are they going to have to still go to parole, you know, meetings? Are they still going to have to do check-ins? And, you know, for a lot of them, they were optimistically cautious that, you know, they hope that, you know, eventually their parole officer would just forget about them, right? And because, you know, there's so many other restrictions when you're on this kind of legal supervision. It restricts where you can go. So it's your mobility, who you can be around. So your networks and friend groups, the types of jobs you can have, which is your economics, your places where you might be able to live or not live. So, you know, just your whole kind of identity can be wrapped up in this. And, you know, for folks who, especially of a certain age, right? I mean, it's really hard to start over.
Right, sure. And I could just add to that. Again, when I was teaching in college courses in New Jersey State prisons, some of my students were in their 60s or 70s. I mean, these were older men, you know, some of whom, you know, clearly had a hard time walking across the room. I mean, they were, you know, just debilitated. I don't know what their condition was when they came into prison 30, 40 years ago, but obviously prison didn't help them to stay in, you know, any kind of, you know, moderately healthy, you know, state. And I remember thinking at the time that it just seemed so absurd that the state of New Jersey was spending thousands and thousands of dollars to incarcerate people who were told by, you know, implication that these are dangerous criminals. These are people who are going to, you know, if let loose, going to do, you know, potential damage to people in society. These people could barely cross, you know, could get across the room. Like, these are people who, you know, maybe needed to be in a retirement center, in a, you know, a elderly care facility. You know, they weren't a threat to anyone. Their biggest threat was falling and breaking a hip, you know. I'm a sociologist, and I also have a particular focus on religion, and I think a lot about religion and religious imagery and influence in our society in general. And I think some of the treatment of people, both in terms of when they're in prison and also when they're released from prison, some of the way that they're treated makes a lot more sense if you think about it from a religious kind of punitive perspective, that we're going to punish this person till their dying day, rather than thinking of it from any kind of legal or ethical or logical or security perspective.
Agreed. Yeah.
All right, so that's that. Let's see. There's so much to talk about. We're gonna run out of time soon. So let's see what we could, get to. Let's talk about this. What recent legal reforms has the state of New Jersey enacted, and how have these reforms fallen short of creating transformative change?
Great question. So New Jersey, along with other states like New York, are kind of seen right now as some of the models in terms of reform. And New Jersey in particular has been kind of carrying out reform since the, you know, at least the way I'm positioned it, since the early 2000s, right? You know, in 2007, Governor John Corzine, who was a Democrat, he abolished the death penalty. And you know, for no other reason other than, you know, the New Jersey anti-death penalty campaign did the report and was like, you're going to save millions of dollars a year by just not having a death house anymore. And so they signed that into law. And so, you know, the New Jersey has taken those actions, which, you know, no longer having the death penalty. We saw in the Republican Chris Christie that he was, you know, open to the idea that, you know, not to kind of bring back a new kind of war on drugs with the opiate crisis. There's been a lot of criticisms that was largely due to the fact that the opiate crisis was impacting suburban white middle-class neighborhoods, not necessarily low-income poor Black communities. But, you know, I would still take that as a win that, you know, we didn't expand the prison system with that. And more recently with Governor Phil Murphy, who is a Democrat, we've seen him sign into legislation at the end of 2019 that New Jersey residents under parole and probation can now vote. Before that, from the mid-1800s till 2019, anyone under any form of criminal justice supervision in the state of New Jersey was barred from voting. We've also seen that during the COVID-19 pandemic, that New Jersey was one of the kind of leading states that released about 2,500 people from its prisons, understanding that this infection was rapidly spreading, especially in the prisons. And we've also seen in the last decade that New Jersey has been one of the leading states of bail reform, right? It often gets overshadowed by New York's bail reform and how the politics of that. But, you know, because of New Jersey's bail reform, we've seen the state prison population almost halved, right? So from roughly around 25, 26,000 people incarcerated to roughly about 12 to 13,000 people in the state prison system. So all of those are great things in terms of reform. And you know, and I do applaud the efforts that groups and in particularly group grassroots activists and others who've pressured the politicians. I never think that the politicians just do it out of a certain altruism, but certainly through a pressured kind of mandate by their constituents who say, we would like to see these things change. Where I have my criticism is that while the numbers have diminished, the populations that are still the most impacted by incarceration within the state of New Jersey remain the same. So over the last decade, the county of commitment, right, the county that leads the way in incarceration remains Essex County, where Newark, New Jersey is. The racial breakdown of New Jersey's in prison incarceration hovers between 59 to 61%, depending on the year, of Black folks. Black folks in the state of New Jersey make up about 14%. So it is a super lopsided disparity between what the state composition of race is compared to the state prison system. In fact, New Jersey is one of, and last time I checked, it was the leading state in the country of racial disparity, with a roughly 12.1 Black to white ratio of incarcerated people. So in essence, the New Jersey prison system is Black, right? It is a Black center, and so when we think about that, if the state population is only 14% of Black people, who are mainly coming from certain areas of the state, Essex County, Camden County, parts of Hudson County, Passaic County, Union County, they're not mostly coming from Cape May or Gloucester or Salem County. We see what, Loic Wacquant talks about, this kind of deadly symbiosis where, America's urban centers, America's ghettos start to look like our prisons, and our prisons start to look like our ghettos. And so the same people who are being disadvantaged even before they get in trouble with the criminal justice system are now in trouble with the criminal justice system and then being released back into those same neighborhoods that are under-resourced, over-policed, over-monitored through surveillance. And so my challenge is that I don't think that we can reform our ways out of this, because what we've seen is that reform can, yes, shrink the numbers, but the concentration remains the same. And so I would argue, and then I advocate for, is that we have to rethink how we even want to deal with justice. And that's where my politics on abolition comes from, is that these systems were intended to be set up for disparity, for social stratification, that very much mirror race, class, and gender lines, right? Because that's who we see across the country, in New Jersey, of who's incarcerated. If you are Black, minority, low income, coming from a particular zip code, your likelihood of ending up in these facilities is at a much higher rate than if you are something else. And so my argument or my challenge is that we really need to rethink what justice looks like. And then after we rethink justice, how do we then get to that goal? And I tend to like to think of my abolition politics is that we have to start with the hardest problem, right? I think why so many people are invested. So many people are invested in criminal justice because crime is emotional. Harm is emotional. Violence sucks, right? People are impacted by violence. And so we have to kind of get at the root of what is causing that violence. Is it poverty? Is it other social cycle, disabilities or accessibility issues? Are there lack of outlets for people to get this? We have to kind of do that. We have to stop kind of having more of a reactive stance where, police just go out and arrest the bad guy. Well, you're only technically a bad guy after you commit a crime. So how do we have a system that is more proactive, that, you know, the folks who are incarcerated get the resources, the help, the facilities that they need before going to prison even becomes an option in their lives? And so I often think of it as that it's never a situation of can we do this, but will we do this, right? You know, we often hear that things like affordable, clean, safe housing, equitable education, universal health care, or pipe dreams, right? That these are things that, you know, cannot happen. Yet we have money, right? I mean, we know that there is money out there for war. We know that there is money out there to bail out banks. We know that there's money out there to rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral, right? I think in less than 24 hours, $1 billion was raised to you know, fix from the fires that the cathedral had experienced. And I think that that's part of the kind of hurdle that we have to go. We have to kind of reorient our culture again away from retribution to one of care. And again, this is not an overnight fix. I don't think that this is going to happen by next Tuesday. But I think that we have to start making those incremental changes to fundamentally shift our position into one that cares about people rather than just says, well, let's further harm people. And that's what prison and by extension reentry does. It further harms people. And so, you know, I talk about in chapter, I think, 4, which I call The Body, which is that leaving prison doesn't mean that you leave all the things that you've experienced in prison behind. If you've been cut across your face and you have a big gnarly scar growing, that doesn't get rubbed off, right? That is something that you now have to live with. So the violence that you might have experienced now is going to maybe impact your romantic life. It might impact your professional life. The traumas that you witnessed, right? The PTSD that you know how now have doesn't just get taken away. And as we all know, in the United States, healthcare is pretty crummy. And so unless you have really good healthcare that covers mental health or psychologist or having a psychiatrist, you might not be able to even professionally seek out help for those traumas that you've experienced. So what do people do? They self-medicate, they cope in other ways. They don't know how to cope. So their anger, their frustration comes out in an explosive, unhealthy manner. And so again, we see how these systems perpetuate those punishments.
Right. Oh, thank you for all of that. This gives us so much to think about. I really want to thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.